how I write is I'll just be playing, strumming on a guitar and doing that, you know, every day consistently, then something good happens out of it. And it's really when your kind of mind shuts off and mm-hmm. you kind of let the muse happen, and it's a really strange thing that, I mean, you're so, because you're there and you're in the moment or whatever, you kind of are responsible, but not really.
I believe that each and every one of us has the power within ourselves to create the life that we really want. And I want to help give you the tools to make that happen. I'm Danica Patrick, and I'm pretty intense. Today is a very special guest that people probably know much better as Citizen Cope, but his real name is Clarence Greenwood. And we got into the business of music. He is a musician. He writes his own stuff, but you'll also understand maybe the root of where it came from at the beginning of the interview, where we talked about what his mom made him do to get allowance to do certain things or get away with certain things or buy certain things, which is really foreshadowing into his whole life of being a writer and a poet. And so we talked about that. We talked about the business of music, about privacy. We talked about the difficulties of the industry. We talk about labeling. I mean, like how the society just is so busy on labeling everything, but he doesn't really have a genre, never really has identified or cared about what it was called that he played, whether it was pop or rock or soul. It just doesn't matter to him. He's just a purist at heart with his music. And we got into spirituality. We got into talking about guys like Eckhart Tolle and Alan Watts, these amazing philosophers that have led him down a really positive path mentally to get to a better place and to retrain his brain to think more positively. And I'm going to tell you, he does. He has turned really difficult experiences into his life, like his father passing and the abuse as a young boy into... he actually could barely even list the bad things that came from it. He really just had only good to say about it, which is an amazing transformation as a human being. So we had a good time today. He finally has come out with another album. It's been 7 years, called Heroin and Helicopters. Fascinating. And it starts out with a song called Duck Confit, which I realized he's also a foodie. So it all makes sense. So please enjoy this show with the wonderful Clarence. I thought what was really interesting and also probably pretty telling about maybe the road that you were going to go down was the story about what your mom made you do to get permission to do things when you were younger.
Oh, to read poems or to learn or memorize them if I wanted to do something, yeah. Which was kind of, I never really thought about that aspect of it until retrospectively I thought about what might have been one of the reasons I started getting into writing and stuff like that. But there was a Robert Louis Stevenson poem called Land of Counterpain, and this other one, Robert Frost, Road Less Traveled. Mm-hmm. And I think when she started giving me trouble about my choice of profession, you know, I said, well, you had me memorize the Road Less Traveled
when I was a kid. What do you expect?
Well, at least that one too.
How young were you when you remember it? Because the Road Less Traveled is a pretty long poem, right?
I think it's pretty long, but I think I wanted something substantial, like to be able to watch the Redskins on Monday night or something.
What did you think of that? Were you like, this is the weirdest thing for you to have me do? Or was that normal? Did you just not know anything?
She was really into English grammar, spelling, table manners, things like that. She went to Catholic school, so she was really into that. And me being a public school guy, I really lacked a lot of the education. And I wasn't very smart scholastically in class or in test taking.
Because you were in public school?
No, because it was just my DNA, I think.
Was it not your interest either? Like,
it wasn't my interest, but I don't think I got really into being intellectual until I started to, probably when I was 18 or 19, I started to really comprehend what I was reading, because I couldn't comprehend what I was reading when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And so it was just, I could read, but it would be reading word for word for word. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, I couldn't really understand the sentence. Mm-hmm.
And like keeping a train of thought going of something?
Right, and I'd read to the end of the page and I think my mind would have gone off somewhere, and then I'm thinking, what
did I just read?
Yeah, what did I read?
Well, you're not alone. That's how that happens to me too. I'll be reading and as soon as you get distracted, you get to the bottom of the page, you're like, hang on. And then you go to the top and it's like the first time you've read it. You're like, I don't even remember looking. I don't remember reading this.
Right.
Yeah.
I think your brain develops in different times and different people learn in different ways. And probably one of the problems with our school system and education system is that we don't allow for that, for our children to have different ways to read, different ways to learn, and really enjoy how amazing it is to actually overcome something like that and actually learn something that is good in school.
Do you think that we go to school? I think it's good to go to school when we go to school. Do you think we do it too early? You said that it was more like 18 or 19 before things started to really register for you. So do you think that's the problem? Like, we should be climbing trees when we're a kid instead of...
Absolutely. I think there's people that really need that. And there's children that can read a book and really need that intellectual stimulation. I was more somebody who wanted to run around and play, and I think recess was fun, and the more people write about it, and right now it's, you know, I think the school system was brought on so that people could work, you know, their parents could work.
Yeah,
and,
true.
And so therefore,
almost for the parents as much as.
Yeah, so you could go to work, and the government can get their money.
So they're cut from being there.
Your parents can go in debt to...
I agree with all of this because there's two parts of that story that resonate with me. One was that when I was a kid, I used to be gone a lot for racing. And so there was a program in school called the Renaissance Program. And if you had a certain grade point average, you could get in. But the other contingency was you had to be at a certain amount of days of school. Like you couldn't miss more than two per quarter or something like that.
Exactly.
And so I was never in because I was always gone too many days for racing, but I would always qualify with my grades. Yeah. And that was when I identified as a very young kid. Oh, it's because you're not making enough money off me, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then of course college. I mean, there's so many people that go to college just stalling. It's culturally more acceptable to go to college and waste your time than it is to go travel and have life experiences.
You're completely. We've got it all wrong. I think that if there's something in college that you know you want to really figure out and learn, if you want to learn how to be a doctor or an accountant or something like that, or if you really just enjoy reading literature and want to express writing and all these kind of things, I think most people use it as a means to an end. And
yeah,
I think it's something that is supposedly done in society so that we're able to go get a good job. And so that whole thing is weird, because I think that a lot of people finish college and realize, I've lived my whole life for some like society norms or my parents' goals or something else like that. So then they become a little bit, you know, that those are the type of people that run off with a guitar to Europe, and just once they decided after, you know, going to some prestigious university. But I think that generally, I think kids go to school too early in the morning, and I've read some things that basically your bones are you're growing too much, and it's not good to be getting to school at 8 o'clock. And
really?
Yeah, especially when you're an adolescent. That's why you're an adolescent. You're so tired at school.
Huh.
Is that your bones are growing and you know, you're taking these classes. And
Getting up at 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning when you should be sleeping till you naturally wake up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a whole lot of things wrong with the structure of it the way it is. What would be the solution if you were in charge?
I think the biggest thing is that teachers aren't being compensated. And I don't think that they're paid well enough, and I think that it would get more people into taking that as a profession. And I think the school systems don't have enough money. So we've really failed at educating our children, which I think is, you know, even when I was in school, I was like, wow, these schools are really not that good. And here I am, all grown up, and we still deal with the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the children are made to take tests and to get these tests done and standardized tests, and that's how they get paid accordingly. And I think it's just an unequal system.
Mm. And what would you encourage for your daughter? How old is she now?
She's eight. And I know her grandmother would kill me, especially on her mother's side, actually on both sides. I would not put her in school.
Period?
No. I would just have her, but there's not any of those. I mean, they say the social thing is important.
Yeah.
But I think you kind of find out what your child is kind of capable of doing and interested in doing. It just seems like a strange thing to send your child off to school every day and you don't get to see them that much.
Let someone else at school raise them
and then
you don't even know. Better.
Yeah, exactly. They're spending 40 hours a week there. And with the way it is now, it's there's not a lot of, you know, running around and not enough recess, no
sure.
music in the schools. The art programs are lacking. So they're kind of basically, they want these children to learn these to get the standardized test thing right. done, so they
making
can
them into little
it's
robots.
A money thing.
Yeah.
Know? So it's
yeah, it's the creativity that kills me. I just feel like when you look at a kid, they, you know, they have imaginary friends. They want to climb trees. They're coloring. They're making things. They, you know, they're just so imaginative. And
right.
then you go into a room with a couple of windows and all these rules, and you know, the perfect metaphor is just like they have to make their picture look just like everyone else's.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's accepted and encouraged and rewarded is
yeah.
The robotic mentality and following rules. And you know, I'm with you on that. And you said that, you know, when you were 18 or 19 was when you felt like it started making sense, but that's and from what I understand, that's when you also realized that you had a knack for writing and that poems started coming out of you really freely. And
right.
it was just after that your great uncle had died, who
yeah.
was like your father.
Right. He was a big father figure to him. He was like my grandfather on my father's side. And I went to a small town in Texas every summer called Vernon. And it was just kind of a really small town, but you know, I just loved going there for some reason, and because of them. And he was a farmer. He had actually had an accident when I was real young and lost his left hand in a cotton gin, and or his right hand, he was just definition of grit to me. So it was just a real inspiration. And when he passed away, and I started writing these poems just right off the top of my head about...
Was it part of therapy? Or like, was this something therapeutic to you? It just felt like something that was calling you because of that incident? Or was it just ironic timing?
It was like cathartic and therapeutic at the same time, because I didn't... You know, I had my own family situation, which at the time nobody kind of understands, and they're coming to terms with how they were raised and good or bad, you know, they go through these periods where they're really kind of thinking for themselves about it, and just the reality of what that meant, and that, you know, my father hadn't been in my life, and but I had this great man, and so I just started writing some poems, and I never really thought that music was what I was going to do for a
while. What were you writing about? Do you remember?
I think I wrote about him. I think I wrote about my father. I think I wrote about just coming back and forth between like Washington, D.C. and Texas. You know, just some poems, but I didn't stop. I just remember not just coming out like
that. Poems are interesting because yeah. There's different styles, right? Mm-hmm. There's certain patterns, and some rhyme, some have certain syllables, some, yeah. Right? Did you learn about the forming of a poem, or was this just your understanding based on what your mom had you memorize when you were a kid?
I think the only thing which isn't even true today, which is you're supposed to start every line with a capital letter.
And that was what you knew?
Yeah, and I knew that you didn't have to necessarily, I mean, poems have a situation where you have to rhyme, but it's not like necessary that you have to rhyme. So I think poems don't really have any laws, just like, you know, you have to just be able to express an emotion that can reach somebody else, or somebody else can understand, something like a song. But there are parameters that go into writing song and poetry and writing books.
Do you have a way to explain how you start writing them, how they take shape? Like, do they have a chorus to them essentially?
Like, yeah, I mean, I think with songwriting, I mean, everyone says, you know, verse, chorus, verse, you know, yeah. Kind of the chorus, bridge, chorus. And I've gotten in trouble for that in the past, or been disagreed about. But, you know, some of the best songs in the world don't follow that format. Mm-hmm. But you're just kind of entranced by it, you know, whether it's Bill Withers or the Beatles. You know, they didn't follow that formula.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, you know, that got to a point where that was, okay, this has to be this way and this has to be that way. But I never felt I had to follow a structure to that, and just pretty much how I write is I'll just be playing, strumming on a guitar and doing that, you know, every day consistently, then something good happens out of it. And it's really when your kind of mind shuts off and mm-hmm. you kind of let the muse happen, and it's a really strange thing that, I mean, you're so, because you're there and you're in the moment or whatever, you kind of are responsible, but not really. It's just kind of, I always try to, people always ask me what this song is about, and it's really, you can go back and read the lyrics, but a lot of times you write a song and it's like, where'd that come from?
Mm. Yeah. So it's almost out of body, foreign to you in some way, but it just came from somewhere and you don't know where it came from.
Yeah, it comes from, I guess, deep in the conscious somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, your mind has more power than we think, so we're not using all our mind. So when we're in that, you know, position where you're just kind of doing it for the love of it,
yeah.
That it has the ability to take you somewhere that you never thought you could do if you were thinking
about it. Do you know when you've hit on it? Like, do you know when you've played and you've started to sing, and then all of a sudden you start going on and you're like, whoa, that's it?
Yeah, I mean,
is there an aha moment?
Especially early on, you feel kind of, there was a couple times where I just felt a release where I had tears of joy. And it was, wow, this is really good. And you get that sometimes, or just get the goosebumps or something like that. But it's more of a kind of a spiritual release at that point.
Is there anything that you have written and played that is there anything off limits? Do you feel like some stuff is too vulnerable and too true and too honest that maybe you don't want people to see that sort of insight or understand that insight, or maybe someone will recognize that it might be about them? Like, do you ever, is anything off limits?
I think the emotion is never off limits, because mm-hmm. emotion's always going to transfer to somebody, be like, oh, that's sad, or that's happier.
Yeah, yeah.
That
you feel
this,
it.
You know, this is something that people, even if they don't know what a song is about, people feel something different, or an energy that is expelled or expressed that people will understand.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's certain personal things that I wouldn't necessarily write about, because also just, not because it's too personal, but just because of the art of songwriting, I think you're able to use analogies and alliterations or whatever they're called.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of, this is about this, but I'm gonna put this in
a different context, or
exactly.
use an analogy for the storyline.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Really nothing is off limits then?
Nothing's really off limits. I mean, I think you can get a little dark sometimes.
I love dark. Bring
yeah.
it. Bring the dark.
So
I'm the kind of person that can like work out to the dark. I love like the deep, like I've always said I love depressing music.
Yeah.
Is there a song that you feel like is your most vulnerable song? Has the most emotional connection for you?
Well, I did a whole record. It was called Shotguns. And it didn't ever come out. And it was my first major record label deal. I signed with Capitol, and they didn't put it out. And in fairness, I don't think the record was completed yet, but I felt the songs were really good.
Mm-hmm.
And it was super personal and super dark. And it was like, there was this song called Shotguns, and it was just about I mentioned this town, Vernon. It was about kind of the death of a city, and also, you know, the line was like, well, accidents, they happen with shotguns sometimes, but this is suicide. And then it kind of dealt with suicide, which, you know, I'd had people in my family deal with that. And so it was touched on that. And then I had a song about Officer Friendly, about a guy killing his brother. So it was like a Cain and Abel kind of theme to the whole story.
How'd that make you feel, that what you can even reflect on now as being your most vulnerable album not being released?
That was tough. I mean, I felt like, because I'd come from, you know, just when I was buying and selling tickets to concert, and I made all these demos.
Like you said, selling tickets to NASCAR races.
Yeah, NASCAR races. And so I thought I'd kind of made it. When you sign a major deal back
yeah.
then, you're like, okay, my songs are as good as this person. I'm going straight to the top.
Did you have confidence? Like, was that not a problem for you?
No, it was definitely a problem. I had confidence in writing songs.
Right.
Which I've had to work a really bad stage fright, so like performing was really hard, and it wasn't like I was gonna be I never thought I'd be a performer. Mm-hmm. I just thought I'd be a songwriter and producer.
So then the album doesn't get published, and
yeah.
it's a vulnerable album, which is like a double hit almost, right?
Because yeah, it was something. It's not like somebody else wrote the song. So I remember getting the call. Like it was yesterday, and they're like, Clarence, we gotta let you go.
Mm.
And I'm like, I don't know what that means.
Where am I going?
And so I just figured I had enough money to, you know, and at the time me and my girlfriend at the time split up, and she was like, well, if you don't make it, you're gonna be miserable, and if you do, you won't ever be around. So I was...
Was she right?
She was probably right. It was probably one of the best things for her that somebody's done for me. But I'd been with her for a long time, so it was like, you know, she was kind of my high school sweetheart. And, it was kind of a very unselfish thing of her to do. So
yeah.
I got this place, kind of a big big room, like a carriage house, and it was like 2,500 square feet, and I'd never lived in somewhere where I could really sing out, and I was always kind of quiet and felt weird about the neighbors and all that kind of stuff. And it was, I think it was like $800, but it was kind of in a prostitute and drug area in DC at the time.
You probably enjoyed your music then.
So there was a lot of good, you know, it was, but there was never any problems there, but it was always, I could just sing out. And so I just started writing a whole new record, because under that record deal, I wasn't allowed to redo any of those songs for 5 years.
Really? So you wrote them,
and then they
still owned them, even though they got rid of you.
I wrote them, I recorded them, they owned the rights to what I'd recorded, and basically that I couldn't record them again for another 5 years.
That's bullshit.
That's the music business.
Tell me about it. What's the most difficult thing about the music business? Or maybe list them. List all of the things.
Well, first I'll say there are a lot of really good people in the music business, but the structure of it's built more as a corporate thing where it's done for every quarter. So I think it minimizes the ability to have really good art and to continue really good artists, because they have to meet their bottom line. So, and once they became corporate, that's what happened. And so it's been a lot of kind of innocuous music being put out and not testing the boundaries. And that said, there's been really good people in the music that have helped me, and you know, that system has helped me a lot, and was able to make records on other people's dime and get a little money in my pocket. And but it is a I think the money is a good thing, but also can be a challenging thing, because people don't, you know, people sign 50 groups and you're just one of them. So it's not, you know, and maybe five out of that 50 will get the record put out, and then maybe one out of those 50 will have a career.
Is it a crapshoot, or is there an element where if you do certain things, you know you have a better chance of being chosen to be released, recorded, toured?
Yeah, I think in a lot of situations, the cream rises to the top.
Yeah.
But you can have really talented people that just took the wrong turn. You know, they signed with the wrong person, or they didn't believe in themselves, and then they had other people write, and they got the wrong producer. And that can happen, you know. So it really has to come if it's really about the art and about the music and about your songs, then you're not going to really let anything stand in the way of you getting the music to the people, because at the end of the day, you can play places and you don't need them to do that. You can try to build your own fan base. You can get your music to people somehow, and that's really what you have to make yourself label proof if you're on a label.
So what's the point of a label then? What do they have to offer that's so great?
They have, for one, most artists don't have the money to make a record and then have the money to spend the time in developing it, and then also touring and marketing and radio are all expenses. And I really didn't get on the radio, but that's a big expense, you know, for, you know, like especially pop artists.
So the record label pays the radio station?
They don't pay them to say, hey, play it, but it costs a lot of money to actually to service those stations. And
what does that mean, service the station? I mean, go ahead, be vulgar. I don't know what this means. Well, it's a podcast. We can swear. We can say whatever we want.
Well, they don't. I mean, if there was a station that actually took money, I would bring bag with it, me and...
So what's service mean then?
It's... you have to go there and your promo person takes them out, and if they're not allowed to be paid directly anymore.
Right.
So you have to hire independents.
Got it.
And an independent will, you know, figure something out, and radio people get, I mean, it's really hard to understand whether the hit song makes itself or if the radio station makes it, because mm-hmm. they don't play other stuff. They all play the same stuff.
That's right.
So, but the actual, to do the promotion of a pop record is millions of dollars.
Yeah.
So I never was on that, in that light, but.
Are you glad?
I would have liked to pop. I would have liked.
Would you have compromised your art to some degree in that position?
I didn't think I had to. I mean, I think there was a point when I was on a major and, you know, they said they're going to want their commercial single, and I felt like I delivered that. When I delivered the record, they thought that was the case.
Mm.
So when I put out the Clarence Greenwood recordings, I was on Arista, which is a big major kind of situation, and they were ready to push the button, and then the whole staff got fired, and it was awful. So I had to.
So it fell apart on you.
It fell apart, and so I got kind of adopted by another label in.
That label dissolve on some level then, just because everybody, or did so much change
it
that
dissolved.
You weren't part of that anymore?
It was dissolved. It was kind of, everyone got fired and they didn't get rehired. So they kind of, for some reason, they shut the label down because it was a big pop label. It was spending a lot of money. It was like Whitney Houston and Santana was on it. So it was a lot of pop groups. So they all kind of got, all the artists got dispersed within other labels in the Sony system at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you have your champions. So your champions believe in you and they understand your vision and they understand the music you're making.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they say, oh, wow, this isn't traditional pop music, but I can take this here. And I know what to do. You know, Jimmy Iovine was always good at that. And L.A. Reid, different executives and stuff.
Well, you don't have an identifiable genre, is that correct?
Yeah, that's always been kind of the difficult thing is, but, you know, with a good song, you can change that genre to get closer to you. And I think,
by changing the music just a little bit,
no,
like the instruments
but,
or the sound, or just the right person bringing it to the right person?
Getting them to believe in it enough to press the button, essentially. You know, there's not going to be very many people that they're going to they can afford to, or they want to press the button. And if something, they have this term in the music business, they say they throw the thing, the gum on the wall, see if it sticks. You know, so it's just kind of sometimes just magical things happen. And then sometimes it really takes a lot. I mean, it takes a lot to break a record. So, I mean, what I did with that record was I convinced them to press a bunch of copies of the full album before it came out, and I was giving it away to people, and people liked it. I would come back and give them more, and they would give stuff away. So I think that was, like, one of the best marketing things I could have done.
I feel like culturally we have an obsession with labeling everything.
Yeah.
You know, everything needs to be identifiable and understood, and instead of experiencing things, we need to have a label, whether it's Democrat or Republican or pop or rock. You know,
back to
you're a Redskins fan or a Packers fan. Like you need a label for everything. You identify with one of 26 and probably growing identifiable genders now. I mean,
yeah, our race, our gender, our culture is all. Is all kind of put into our what we feel like we need to protect or to promote, and all that really doesn't matter on your dying bed, you know. So I guess it's important to figure that out before you're there.
Well, or not. We can evolve as people. We don't always have to be the same person. We don't have to believe in the same thing today and next year.
No, I know. I'm just saying it's figure out that it's not important, like all those things that we think that we hold on to
as far as
our identity, and that we don't necessarily sometimes are kind of operating on a lower frequency, because we're all part of the same thing. We're all part of the same universe.
Right. You know, what I know that something that kind of is not in your comfort zone, you mentioned you don't like being on stage. Have you gotten over that, by the way?
Yeah, I've gotten over it. I still get a little nervous, but I used to have just... It was hard. They call it stage fright for a reason.
But the public and like being recognized and, you know, the public's obsession, like this addicted society to, you know, people or things, stuff, you know, this obsession with fame and it's, you know, has that been challenging for you?
Well, I think the strangest thing to me is the cameras and the TV, and that people always want to take pictures, and I think that that is one of the things since the cell phone came up that's completely changed.
I feel like Taylor Swift had it right. She said selfies are the new autograph.
Yeah.
She's right.
Well, she
that was a long time ago she said that, but.
Yeah, I mean, people don't. It's almost like a drug. You see them pulling their phone out and they come and they don't have really any interest in having any kind of true meaningful conversation or anything like that.
I agree.
It's just a picture. It's not, there's not any kind of exchange, which I think
or
is
experience.
Yeah, we're missing out on you know, how did you hear the music, or how did you, or he says. This, you know, and a lot of times you do get people that have a personal story about it, but it always comes with a picture. You know, when my daughter was younger, I stepped out of a cab one time, and this guy's like, "I take a picture of you." And I'm like, "I'm with my daughter, and I had her in my arms." She's like, "Well, she can be in it too."
Like, I don't think you're understanding me, sir.
But I've literally had people write in, and you know, because I stopped taking pictures for a long time, and now I can't win that fight anymore. So it's like, all right, I'll take a picture. But people just writing in.
How does it make you feel when that's what they want?
Well, I understand it's just digital currency now. It's just a way to feel that. I've heard people say, "Well, how am I going to let my people know that I was here?"
Oh, you'll just have to tell them that if they'll believe you. Unless you're a rapid liar, then of course no one's going to believe you, and that's why you need the photo.
Exactly.
Yeah, that connection, I agree. You know, people will want an autograph or want a picture or something, and I remember a long time ago saying, "Don't you just want to, like, say hi, good luck, and have a couple words with me?" Isn't that more memorable than no interaction at all and just an autograph you can buy online?
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't you want to just say something to me?
It takes longer for somebody to figure out the camera and then do the whole thing, and then it would, and then you get the picture, and then there, like you say, there's no interaction with that.
So if you had to choose between a 2 to 3 minute conversation with a fan versus a photo,
I would have a conversation.
Yeah.
I think that I enjoy that. You know, I'll give you a hug and hello and.
Where was my hug when I came in? Then? You were carrying a guitar, that's why.
But there is that, you know, there's that, and so many people have it. It's wild that the level of it. Like, people that are on television, it's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, because they have to always be on, or a lot of athletes and stuff like that, where it's I mean, you guys have it all the time, where people that see me normally know my music or been to a show, and so there's a level of authenticity to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I still would like to go out at the end of the night and just be like, "What's up?" and da 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 da, and it not
relax in public spaces
and just say hello to people and just have conversations and not necessarily be about the pictures, you know?
Yeah, the superficial part of it,
the
fleeting part, the non-connective, right? I mean, look, you're a poet, so you connect with words and you connect with emotions.
Yeah.
And when someone snaps a picture, that's the opposite, yeah. You know? There's no connection there.
And I don't think I got it in. I mean, I definitely wanted to make my life better and all that and prove people that didn't think I was going to do something. You know, there were those, like, kind of lower level, you know, introduction reasons that I got into things. But I think I always saw that fame is so fleeting. It's like no matter how famous you are, the next person is, that's gonna, you know, I remember when I was a kid, they had a show called The Partridge Family.
Yeah.
And they were all like superstars. And
yeah.
It was like there was only five channels. And it's like, you know, there's new stuff.
And it's a matter of what's next, right? You have to do one more thing that's crazy or more revealing or more controversial, and you know, you that's what you have to do to just stay on the radar so that you can get casted in a movie or have your album come out or be number one with the label or whatever it may be that's in your profession that you feel like you need. So what would you have as advice for someone that was getting into the music industry based on what you've learned?
I wouldn't.
Really?
No, I'm joking. I would just say you have to really love it more than you love the rewards you're going to think you're going to get, because those rewards aren't going to really be fulfilling to you.
Right.
So that what's most fulfilling is when you can break through on a song or make something that you thought you never could do or kind of go outside of what you thought you could do as a human. And then those are the rewards. The rewards aren't the money and the fame and all that stuff. Those are really, really kind of baseline things that happen.
Well, they happen as a result of doing something you're passionate about, right?
Right?
Because that resonates. Like you said, people resonate with that frequency and that energy of a song having meaning and depth.
Yeah.
And I agree. I 100% agree.
Yeah.
And so much of society, and I've been guilty of it.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking for validation or something outside of you to make you feel better, when what you have to do is you have to find that within yourself, because if you're looking outside of yourself to feel good,
right,
it's either going to be temporary or just not happen.
Yeah.
And it's for sure going to be disappointing beyond what happens when you disappoint yourself.
Right.
So looking within to figure out how to be happy is, of course, I love that self-growth. I think that's one of the things that is lost in, you know, it's not that it's completely lost, but I feel like in my exposure with religions, let's say,
right,
it's always about going outside of yourself. Ask for the forgiveness. Go do this. Go do something instead of going, what about you? What are you thinking about? How do you feel? Like,
yeah,
more self-reflection and self-improvement. Did you grow up going to church or like
well,
a religion?
Yeah,
or?
Not a weekly thing, but my grandmother on my mother's side was devout Catholic, and then in Texas, they were pretty heavy Presbyterians. So it was, my mother got a divorce, so she wasn't really into the church. She would go back every once in a while. But so I was christened as an Episcopalian. So I never really went to many days in church. But the whole, like in Texas, there was like 50 churches and all this.
In town.
Yeah, and it, you know, all of them had different ideas, and I remember seeing something or reading something where there's like, the guy said there's a lot of church, but they don't know if there's a lot of God in the church, you know? And so I never felt the religious dichotomy. I felt there was a spiritual something higher. I believed in something higher, and I believed that there was, and I didn't know what it was. I couldn't say that that's Jesus or that's Allah or that's...
Technically, nobody knows.
Yeah, so I think that, and I really commend people who feel like that they know that and that it's helped them to another level. But I just know that it's helped me as far as knowing that there's something more powerful on earth than just, you know, all the stuff that's going on, good or bad.
And does that how does that affect your life? I mean, so you describe yourself as spiritual then?
Maybe? Yeah. I think just knowing, kind of wanting to treat people the way you want to be treated, and it's the golden rule. It's all. I think all religions have a lot of the same basic premises.
I agree.
And so that a lot of those things are important to live by. And I do believe that, but the laws is something that I feel are a little strange. Well, this person is not allowed to go to the dance, or this person's not allowed to drink liquor, or this person's, you know, I think when you have, or he's not allowed to listen to this type of music, when you have those things, it just pushes people toward those things. And I think that's why you have so much, you know, sin in the church, and you have so much, you know, there's, you know, between men and women, it's kind of messed up what men and women really have in a relationship. And I think it's because it's been told that this is what you're supposed to do as a man, and this is what you're supposed to do as a woman, and sex is supposed to be this way, and it's supposed to be for this, it's not supposed to be enjoyed, and it's whatever you feel, you're not really, you're kind of guilted into thinking, okay, well, I can't do this.
Or I'm gonna go to hell.
Yeah, and if I don't get married before I do this and that, and I think it just brings on this, I think Alan Watts, the philosopher, said something about how it felt like Christianity and Judaism was one of the things that made men in the West so obsessed with sex. Because
it was not allowed.
Yeah.
And, on some level. Love Alan Watts. He's great to listen to. He's he has such a powerful, simple voice. I listened to about 45 minutes on Alan Watts I've listened to many of his bits and recordings, but he is a really fascinating philosopher, and he puts very complex thoughts in a simple way. The most recent one was about 50 minutes, and it was about realizing like the journey to yourself,
right,
and what the self is. And I love to hear him laugh in his videos too. And he'll just start talking, and all of a sudden he'll just laugh at his own conclusions that are so simple, and he's like, don't you all get it?
Yeah.
He doesn't say that, but it feels like that, like it's this simple, people. But how did you arrive at, I've read that you said that all of your music is about consciousness.
Yeah.
Explain that. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think it's just, even if I write about a character that's not me or something, I feel that I've lived a lot of people, like I'm part of that person. So if there's a flawed individual in that, a lot of the stuff that I might write is not saying, okay, this is a bad situation or that's a bad situation, because I've done that myself, and I have a song called Bullet and a Target, and
people, never heard of it. What do you mean?
but it can be looked at as society doing all this and religion and the government and all this, but it can also be, you know, you point your finger at yourself as well. And so I think that...
A little bit along the lines of we're all one, kind of a...
Yeah, I think that for a long time I lived in the life, and I'm still struggling with it, of the past and the future. And so, okay, there was a point where I was motivated to do things in my life because of my past and what I wanted in the future. And I didn't really realize the importance of being kind of present and in the moment. And I think when I started writing songs, I didn't know this, but that's where it was taking me. It was taking me to some place where all that stuff didn't matter. And even performing was hard to get in that. So it was like, you know, I do feel that there's part of the world and our life and that is not at all, you know, nice. And there are, because of what we've been born into, there's people that do really bad things.
Sure.
And groups that we were talking about, labels and all this kind of this. When people are labeled into one kind of group, us Americans or the Russians or the communists,
right,
or the capitalists, we have a tendency to even, it can be in a group kind of like mob mentality,
mm-hmm,
where we can even do worse things to each other. Religions have gone and, you know, Catholicism has been responsible for many people dying.
That's right.
And so I do think there's an aspect of us all being part of the, you know, universe, not just people, but the rocks and the mountains and all that other stuff, the air, because we're part of it. And
what woke you up to that? Like, was there a moment or something that happened where things just started to make sense?
I started doing some meditation, but I think before that, I always realized, you know, it wasn't good to steal. I could steal something if I wanted to. I could walk into a store and steal it. And it was like, felt that there was just certain things that you could do that you don't have to necessarily make somebody else a victim of you getting in the way. You know, if somebody else is in the way, is a better way to, you can still succeed or do what you have to do without somebody else being.
Was that something that punished? You were thinking, or was that like an emotional feeling? Did you feel empathy? Was that, were you feeling?
Yeah, I think I had
more
I think all
connection?
Artists, I think all artists have, or at least me, has a pretty big sense of empathy, but I think that's pretty much because, and that's a bad thing, you know, you can be empathetic, and then that's why when you feel people's vibes or feel the suffering or the pulse in the world that,
mm-hmm,
you know,
yeah,
it leads you to all these other things, like possibly having substance abuse problems or all these other things that can go along with that when you're an artist. And I think most people that even that aren't artists that are empathetic kind of struggle with that. And because this world will, there will be people that will definitely take advantage. And you don't think as a person that because you wouldn't do it, they'll
think they won't.
Yeah. And that took me a long time to realize.
Did you have to learn that the hard way?
Absolutely. I wouldn't do that.
Was this people that were part of people you loved, or was it strangers that would do this?
Well, you know, I don't want to put myself, I was never victimized by anything. I put myself in all these positions.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that, like, there are risks to doing things that you want to do.
Yeah.
And there are going to be people that want what you have. If somebody robs you, you know, or takes your money or whatever it is, comes in your house or puts a gun to your head, it's like, it's, you know, you're not necessarily, you know, there's things that you can learn from that. So it's not necessarily being a victim of it.
Mm.
You know, even the things that happened with my record company and all that kind of stuff in the over the years, I always felt like you know, there was a long time I was like, man, this person, this asshole, this guy, But I learned from it.
Yeah.
So there was life lessons that go along with that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, speaking of, you know, kind of self-reflection, dealing with things,
yeah.
is in the 7 years that it was between you writing your most recent album this year in 2019 was 2012, and in the middle of that your dad died, is that right?
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, I don't know how much you're willing to go into it, but he was not around. And
yeah, I was estranged from my father, and he kind of was part of my life when I was younger, but I don't remember my parents being together, so I used to go down to Texas and stay with his side of the family. And,
that was something you had to face, right?
Yeah, it was just, you know, I talked to him before he passed away. We actually kind of came to some terms, and I kind of wish my sisters had done the same thing.
Why?
Because I saw him not as somebody I had to fear, but just kind of as a flawed individual and a flawed, weak individual. And I didn't, that kind of gave me the power to feel, you know, not to have hatred in my heart about it. Because for a while there was some really strange emotions going on about it. Not just about not being around him, but or the things that go along with that, you know, not, you know, getting a call on your birthday, or just people disappearing and not even calling you for years. And then, but you know, there was some physical stuff that went on, so it was like, you know, that I dealt with him. And I was probably pretty too young to—
How old were you?
Like 8, 9 years old, you know. But I think when he left, I was in the fifth grade. But you know, it was some pretty deep things. And then I realized that his father had done the same thing to him. And that was just the way, you know. But you know,
subconscious programming.
Yeah, and you're not really, you don't understand when, because sometimes that happens, and then. Because pretty much everyone in that, you know, growing up in my day had to deal with that. But
really?
Well, a lot of people did, I'm sure. I mean, a lot of people got beat and stuff. So.
Do you think that was different for girls or boys? Or do you think that was an era?
I think it was probably different from girls, but I hope it was. I think that was probably a rite of passage for a boy to get beat by their father or something, you know. It was probably like somewhat of a badge of honor also.
What did it do to you?
I think it made me, like I was saying, it just had fear of certain things, I think. And I was operating.
Like that someone was going to beat you up, or fear of someone disappointing you? Or what does it mean when you say you were scared of him, or it gave you fear?
Well, I was scared of my father for a while because of that. You know, and what was weird about when I saw him, I was like, okay, he's just this guy that's kind of like awkward, and you know, he's showing me some papers and a check that he got. And, you know, it's just kind of, you see them in such higher levels when you're younger, and then to realize that they're just human, and that. Like nobody in their right mind would, you know, beat a child with a metal hanger. You know, like that's just not something that you would think somebody would do, but that happens, and it happens a lot.
If you were to take a positive and a negative from that experience, what would it be?
I think the positive is that I would never touch my children, and it took me a while to even have children. Because I think that physically, and another positive, it drove me to be a great songwriter. And I think that it gave me experience, and it kind of toughened me up a lot, and I think, And I think at the same time, it probably made me a lot kind of not tough, you know, because realizing that your father would do that to you.
Yeah.
Just that, and just, you know, it's not, I think there's more positives to it than negatives, I think.
You have a great ability to be able to spin things in a really positive way. Have you always been positive, or is that
I think I lived, I feel like I lived out of fear in a lot of ways, because I even just, what motivated me was out of fear and realizing that that's not what I want to be motivated by anymore. And so and realizing he wasn't that wasn't directed toward me, that was his own thing. And I think a lot of times people, I have friends whose parents or family members are heavily have drug problems and stuff like that, and it's like their own battle, and it's affected them deeply, but it was something that if you continue to concentrate on that negative aspect, it'll take you, if you use it as a motivation, it'll take you to a certain point, but it can't take you up there. It's like that
well
there's,
said.
There's no way you can go really, really, you know, up there.
That's until potentially infinite as opposed to a threshold.
Right. And there is a ceiling that can take you to. And if you want to be at that ceiling and knock your head against it all the time, then use that as...
How did you learn that?
I don't know. I
mean, did you go to therapy? Did you have a good friend that helped you with that? I mean, these are deep concepts that are difficult to understand unless you sought them out through someone, from someone, read something, watched something on TV, watched some video or listened to a podcast, which wasn't happening 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Right.
But that's how I learn now. I learn from my friends, from listening to things, watching things, reading. And, you know, those are deep. That's self-actualization is difficult.
Yeah. Well, I think it's been everything, you know, all those things that have come together as far as trying to seek out some type of philosophy or this kind of readings and this.
Well, you did mention Alan Watts.
Yeah. So. And you
how did you hear Alan Watts?
I got turned on to him. I was watching some other podcasts and stuff. I love Eckhart Tolle.
Oh, yeah, me
He's
too.
He's been really helpful for me.
He's the other one that has the giggle.
Yeah.
Both of those guys have the giggle. They do. They'll say something, and especially Eckhart, it'll just be like this. And then he'll explain something so simply, and he'll like land on like a conclusion or something, and he'll just giggle. It's the same thing as Alan Watts.
And sometimes he pisses me off because he's like, when he giggles, he's like, you know, if you want to live your life like that, hey.
That's
and
right.
I'm like, yeah, that's how I've been living my life.
You're like, don't laugh at me.
Exactly.
Don't belittle me.
Yeah.
So you listen to some of that stuff.
Listen and read. Yeah. And before that, there would just be little kind of books and stuff like that that you would kind of come across. And
you have a favorite?
I remember Oprah Winfrey was like, turned me on. I think she turned me on to Eckhart Tolle too. And I don't from her
Super Soul stuff?
From her show. No, it was before
from
that.
From her show.
Yeah, but I think that it's weird because I didn't watch Oprah very much. And I didn't really watch TV shows very much. But for some reason, it was like there was a couple things she had on her show. And okay, let me check this out. It was supposed to be.
Do you believe in like frequency and energy?
Definitely.
I mean, we've already touched on it,
but
like the fact that possibly you were raising your frequency or your vibration, and it sort of met that frequency of Eckhart Tolle on Oprah.
Right.
Like at that level, you were feeling that kind of energy. And so, you know, the like attracts like kind of theory.
Yeah.
Do you believe in that?
Absolutely. I think there was a time recently I went to this meditation thing. I kind of call it like meditation for dummies. Because I never.
Everyone feels dumb meditating. You're not alone. Everyone's like, "Am I doing it right?"
I never understood it, and this guy was explaining what the mind does, and I went like on a
in meditation.
Yeah, or what it does, and what the mind is basically teaches us to. And totally talks about the same thing, Alan Watts. Like it's ancient wisdom, and I think we've been. Excuse me. We've been fooled to not understand what this ancient wisdom really was, and we've kind of lost sight of that.
Yeah.
And that our mind is can somewhat be our enemy. And I mean, that's not what they say, but I kind of like, it's like, wow, that sounds like the devil at work.
In the game of polarities, it's your ally and your enemy, right?
Yeah.
It's not nothing, it's something, and it can be over here too. It can be very helpful, but it can be absolutely debilitating, which is your heaven and hell on earth, you know?
Yeah, and it completely. And he just kind of did these meditation practices, and I was doing them, and somebody from class said, "Are you still doing them?" I was like, "Yeah." And I was like, how? I was like, I just felt like I really needed it because my mind was just racing. And it was all this stuff that goes on in the world and your life.
So are you a regular meditator now?
Yeah, but I'm more, I started out with the whole guided meditation thing, and I stopped using that person. It was this guy, Joe Dispenza. He did this.
I just talked to Joe a week or two ago.
Yeah. He's
fascinating.
Yeah. And he really explains what your mind is doing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of when you realize that that's what you've been doing, then there's kind of like a, what are you going to do about it?
Well, either you're going to keep repeating the same story.
Yeah.
Which, of course, he says, you know, over time, it's 50% of it at least isn't even real anymore. Maybe even gets to the point of nearly the whole story isn't real anymore. But you have to reprogram your mind to create a new reality. And to create a new personal reality, you're going to need a new personality, and you're going to have to think different.
Completely. Yeah. I was...
How long ago was that?
That was a couple years ago. I did this thing for like 4 days.
One of his retreats. He says he only does 7 days now. I'm like, all right, I'll go. He's like, you're supposed to do this online course first for like 9 weeks. I'm like, can I skip that? And he's like, maybe.
Well, I had the thing, it was like, I think I did the online thing, but it wasn't 9 weeks. It was, maybe I was supposed to do it over 9 weeks, but it was nine episodes or five episodes.
Yeah.
And went there.
Was it worth it? Was it worth doing that? Because look, if it's all about improvement,
it's improvement. I think it was completely worth it because then it kind of gave me an idea of what meditation, that's why I call it meditation for dummies. I didn't really know what it was. I understood, you have to say a breath or a mantra or all these different things, but I didn't, he kind of explained what the mind was doing. And and then I started kind of dozing off during meditations.
Yeah.
And then kind of rose to where it wasn't that, and then having feelings of euphoria, which I'd never felt before, which were kind of, and they say it's different for everybody. Some people see visions and,
hear things.
Yeah.
So
I think it definitely was a cool experience.
Would you say it changed your life?
I mean, I think it was one of the things, but I think there's been so many things that have changed my life, but I think it definitely improved my quality of life.
Yeah. And what do you do different now because of it?
I think it's evolved
now
into something where I can somehow get into the state of meditation without meditating and also performing and not, and a lot of stuff that Watts and Tolle talk about too is just basically not losing my cool. And this business is so hard to not lose your cool, and your ego gets involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and I still do lose my cool, but there's, I'm starting to learn how to be aware that that's happening. And, you know, somebody just steal right in front of, you know, take, you know, I'm not paying you type thing. And then, you know, we're taught, oh, you have to defend yourself and all this kind of stuff, you know. So I think that's helped. Probably just my relationships have been an improvement.
In what way? More patient with those too.
Yeah, because, you know, the once you realize that ego is basing a lot of, you're basing a lot of stuff on ego.
Yeah.
And past experiences.
Yep.
And what you can have in the future, then you don't, you're not leaving yourself enough time. And physically, I've felt a lot of those bad energies leave my body in meditation.
So it's, really?
Yeah. Like
did they want to come back on some level? Did you feel like an energy shift at some times going back that way?
No. Kind of like, well, you had moment, but it just almost like it was. I don't know how to explain it, but it was like almost a massage for the spirit.
Damn.
Where it was coming out and releasing this stuff. And I don't know, it wasn't bad. It felt good.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It was just, I guess there was, I think when you are in that position where you do rely so much on your past and future, then if you're the most kind of unconscious person, then that's how you kind of reach some kind of consciousness. And you know, luckily I wasn't somebody that tried to put ill will toward people or, you know, never felt that need.
Yeah.
But
I feel like for me with energy, it's like I haven't ever felt anything quite like that before where there's a body euphoria. I can get that through certain kind of breathing techniques and things like that where it's like a full body tingle, like euphoria, something else. Like your whole body feels so amazing. I can get that from breathing. But for me with energy, what it was is that as I was improving my life and my thoughts and the way I reacted to people, and I felt like it was a rise in frequency, and that the things that were below that, no longer certain people or certain activities or things like that, they didn't resonate with me anymore. I wasn't even interested in them anymore. They weren't interesting to me. They seemed like a waste of time. So for me, it was more about like they fell away of importance.
Yeah.
And I didn't even feel good entertaining certain thoughts or certain people or certain things. I had to get away from them because they didn't feel good actually. Did you feel like that?
Yeah, that's a freeing moment.
Yeah.
And then that does make you feel a lot better.
Yeah.
One of the things that was interesting about one of the Tolle things he was talking about, he was saying how you have to, how people don't spend a lot of time in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that he actually did a reference to a race car driver.
Really?
And he said that,
I was wondering why your hand was up on the wheel.
You don't have to be, you know, jumping or climbing some cliff that's gonna, you know, there's a lot of people that the only way they can get to that moment is like some life harrowing experience. I was going to ask you, what did you think about when you were driving?
I mean, I didn't feel like I was going to die. I mean, it was more of like it's been said to me that it's probably was like, I enjoy moving meditation. So for me, it might be like a walk, or that I almost feel like I get into like a mental trance of something, or very connected feelings of sensitivity, whether it's like gratefulness or beauty. The veil is so thin then.
Right.
So I can be on a walk with my dogs and just kind of start crying because I just feel like it's so freaking beautiful. The dogs are so happy. I'm so happy. Life is so good. But that doesn't happen in my waking life walking around. I'm not like, oh, wow, I'm driving a really nice car to this big mansion and going to dinner with these certain people. I don't just go, I'm so happy. It takes sort of like a certain atmosphere. for that for me. But I would say that it's been described that that's probably was my moving meditation.
Right.
And that makes sense because that's what I relate to now. But I would feel very... I felt alone. That's how, I mean, I didn't feel like anyone else was around or anything else was going on. I didn't ever feel like anyone was looking at me.
Yeah.
Which is why I threw things and kicked things because I just, I really like was in my own world. And so you're very much responding on, it's very reflexive.
Right.
Like you, that's why experience pays off at that job is because you, based on all your past experiences, can help lead you to a better decision on track because you don't have time to think.
Like life.
So it's almost very out of body.
Yeah. Did you, I mean, so you wouldn't be like, oh man, I didn't feed the dogs today.
Oh, probably not.
Did your mind like ever, it's just always.
You know what, actually, the one thing that would happen to me on track that I would be like, why is this happening? Or like, why is it that one? Is I would sometimes get a song in my head.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And I would just be singing it out there, and I'd be going down the straightaway singing the words going, that is the dumbest song. Why am I singing it? Like, I can remember one time I sing like a, it was a like a Miley Cyrus song or something like that. Why that one? Why not let the drummer kick?
Yeah, why not?
Like I said, that was on Aaron's playlist.
All right.
For like pregame playlist. So I probably wasn't listening to the right music, but.
I heard about that story.
Yeah.
But I didn't believe it.
Somebody, how long ago did you hear about that story?
This was a long, this must have been 10, 15 years
ago. Yeah, he said, that's what he's like, oh my God, you're gonna talk to him? He's like, Let the Drummer Kick was on my playlist, on my pregame playlist for so long. He was so excited.
Somebody said, did you know that Aaron Rodgers, your music is on there? And I was like,
yeah.
That would be cool. I didn't know if it was true. And you just verified it.
Yeah, true story. Your music resonates with people. And I think that, you know, you are an incredible storyteller.
Right.
It's really wonderful.
Yeah, thank
you. Before we get into that, I just kind of want to talk about your daughter.
Okay.
And how, you know, maybe that's, I mean, like, how has that changed? I mean, I don't have kids, but people ask me all the time. But and so how, so you were 40-ish when you had her,
42? Yeah.
I'm creeping up on that.
Yeah. She just, I guess I never felt that love before. So even though I've been, had plenty of love in my life, but having that amount of, or being way somebody says, you know, daddy or something like that, it's just like, oh my God, it's just, I always say having a child is the most selfish thing you can do, so. Even though
why would you say that?
I guess because, I mean, they look like you, and then you get to get all this love, and, you know, and then they're just, I think that it's kind of a new experience, and that people always say, oh, it changes your life, and I don't really feel like it changes your life. I think it just changes your circumstances, but also allows you to really benefit highly off of somebody else's presence. But I always felt like I wasn't going to do it.
What made you finally decide to do it?
I don't know. I just got pushed into it, I guess. Convinced.
Is it true then? You're never truly ready.
You're definitely never ready. No.
What is
the first time they have, like, you think you're ready for anything, and then they start, your fever gets up to 100-something, and you're like, oh, my God.
I have two dogs, and my life is about trying to keep them alive. And I think I saw a cute coffee cup that said something like, task today, keep children alive.
Yeah.
Like, that would, I don't know, I feel like, you know, obviously with dogs, they're dogs and they have, you know, primal instincts to survive.
Yeah.
But kids need everything.
Especially in the, you know, especially guidance and understanding. And the thing is, they're not going to be you, and they're going to have different goals, and they're going to have different experiences, and they're going to be raised a different way. So how they are in their spirit and their soul is, kind of, some people believe children choose their parents. You know, I think that's pretty out there, but, you know, that could be true. And then there's for their own growth and development. And then I just haven't, she's just amazing. She just makes me, makes you happy, and then she make you sad when she says something to you. She goes, "Daddy, you've been gone for two months."
She's probably going to school these days too. So
she's,
you're like, "See ya, back to school." It's, sad things.
Yeah, you're just seeing how society can mold them. It's not just you.
Is that scary?
Yeah, and then things that they're struggling with, and things that they really. Seeing joy, seeing them experience something for the first time.
Yeah. What has she taught you about yourself since she's come along?
Well, she taught me I could be a good father.
That's beautiful.
I didn't think, I was like, her mother says, "You're a natural at this." And I was like, you should have more.
Oh, okay. That's probably the best case scenario then for having a child, is to maybe not be convinced, but then be like, maybe you should have more.
Yeah, I mean, at least I'm good up to this point. I don't, you know, I haven't messed up.
Was that part of why you didn't write an album for 7 years?
Yeah, I was pretty much, we'd moved from New York, and I was just spending time with her, and then me and her mother were going through some difficult times personally, and then I didn't really feel that inspired. I was always writing and stuff, but, and then I'd be on the road and do some shows, and then it just kept on going.
Yeah.
And it seems like a lot of time, but it didn't seem like that long to me, but it was.
Did you have a lot of content then when it came around to write this album? Or
I had a lot of songs. They weren't, you know, because I was struggling in my relationship, I don't feel like they were going in the right, on the right frequency, as back to frequency.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
And, but, and also not being kind of, I always kind of want to be in one place and be comfortable in that place. And I was just kind of moving around from hotels, Airbnbs, and then be on the road and then kind of thing like that.
So did you have a house actually to live in, or were you just really moving around?
I was moving around. Like, Dave moved out here, and I was in New York, and then I was just like, I got to go out there to be with her. So I just moved out here and was kind of doing that. And I always used to go to Jamaica and write for a couple of weeks and run on the beach and do that kind of stuff. And I was just not at that. I wasn't at the point mentally or spiritually where I felt like that I would be getting anything good out of it.
Did something happen in particular that made you go, now, I'm ready?
It was just time, you know, it was just time to do it. I'd written some really good songs, and I had one song that I thought was great, and I recorded it like 5 times, and it just didn't happen. And I just put it down. I said, okay, that's not gonna work. And then went on with some other stuff. And I think it's just when you get a good song, you know, okay, this builds on the next one.
Yeah.
And that builds on the next one. And then you have kind of a amount of,
what was the first song that got written from this new album?
I think it was Justice. I'd written that a while ago, but I hadn't recorded it, and I recorded that. And Hours on End, and I'd written Duck Confit a long time ago. So I just...
Is that more of a poem, or is that a song?
It's a poem, like a spoken word poem.
Yeah.
And I just felt it was so kind of cinematic that it should be the first song on the record, but it was a poem, and I got a poem, a little small chapbook that I'm gonna put out next year.
I was gonna ask that.
Yeah.
You having recited poems as a child, writing poems as a teenager, and then writing music.
Yeah.
Where is your poem book?
Yeah, well, it's coming out. I
had a book come out. Yeah. it was called Poems, not Poem, Poems, not spelled correctly. But I wrote about three or four of them and stapled them together with the cover page. It was, stapled in the top left corner.
Yep.
Poems was written really big on the front, spelled wrong every time. And I went and sold them in the neighborhood for $1.
That's awesome.
My mom still has it, I think. I saw a picture of it. I was like, probably not going to make it onto a Citizen Cope album.
Those things are probably worth a fortune right now.
Well, maybe when I'm dead. Art tends to be worth even more when you're dead.
Exactly.
Isn't that a shame?
Yeah, it is.
I really feel bad for artists. I think that it's not as bad for a musician, although, of course, I'm sure Michael Jackson's originals and everyone who is someone, right. An artist, when they pass away, something changes. Yes, because you can't make more.
Yeah.
But like,
I don't
artists that paint and things like that make sculptures.
Musicians get to at least reap some of the benefits.
Some.
I think, who was it that was just completely pretty much unknown? It wasn't Monet, was it?
He's pretty well known.
No, before he died.
Oh, that wasn't well known, but until he died, and then his art took off after he died?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe.
I'm not sure.
Or, I don't know, was Van Gogh?
It was Van Gogh. And,
yeah, he probably did have to die for his artwork to be really popular, because he died of syphilis, right? Because he literally went crazy.
Yeah,
he cut his ear off.
Oh, God.
That sounds bad. Go to the doctor, everybody.
Yes. I don't think they had penicillin back then, though. Was syphilis cured by penicillin? No,
I'm not really sure. I also wasn't sure why you knew.
Because I one time I did get, what's it called? Not syphilis, but something down there where it was
gonorrhea?
It was burning when I was...
Oh, God.
Way, way back before my music days, and I had to go to get the doctor's penicillin.
You know what? Modern medicine is really modern medicine is really good for immediate traumas, right? I don't believe in modern medicine other than when you need it that moment, like penicillin, because it burns when you pee and you need medicine. But the rest of it should come through food.
Yeah,
food is medicine, and let that medicine be thy food.
Exactly.
Amen. So the album is called "Heroin and Helicopters," and that's obviously an interesting title.
Yep.
Because you haven't done heroin, right?
Nope. I got that title from Carlos Santana the first time I met him. He came backstage.
Did you meet him way back in the day when you were on your first record label? Or you said that it dissolved?
After that, I put my first record out that has Drummer Kick on it.
Yeah.
And he came backstage and we introduced and all that. And he says, whatever you do, stay away from the two H's. And I'm thinking,
whores? No.
Yeah, I'm like
what?
I can think of a lot of things. And he said heroin and helicopters.
Wait, horses with a W. Nobody judge me for that, please. Jesus.
Hoses with the H.
Hose, thank you. We're really going good places now. I can't tell if our vibe is higher or lower, but it's fun.
It's going down a little bit. Gonorrhea and hose.
So he said stay away from heroin and helicopters.
Yeah. And so...
Have you?
Yes. I stayed away from... I was always scared of any kind of needles and all that kind of stuff. So, But I did take a helicopter recently to a private event. And I was like, no, I don't want to do this. But like, I had to do it.
Turns out I can't levitate yet.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to do this. How long was the helicopter ride?
It wasn't that long. It was from Kingston to Port Antonio in Jamaica.
Is that an island or is it just another place on the island?
It's just another place.
Uh-huh.
And Kingston, it was like a 4 or 5 hour drive.
Oh.
And we had to get there in like an hour for this rehearsal and the show. So it took like 25 minutes to fly in the helicopter. It was good. Like a former guy from Jamaican military drove us, and it was...
You were safe.
It was safe.
You know what I always tell people? the pilot doesn't want to die any more than we do.
No.
So just chill out. Like, yeah, it'd be good if he's good at his job and all, but he didn't want to die either.
No. And I think the thing with helicopters, though, which even scared me more, as somebody told me in Hawaii one time, was that it's always a technical malfunction, normally, that makes them crash.
Can't do anything about that.
Yeah, so...
So is there a certain feel or vibe? You said you start with a song and then it kind of goes from there. Is there sort of a message, a call to consciousness with this record that is meaningful or significant in the record?
I think I just try to keep it true to my heart and at the end of it, and if I don't feel any thorns or in the bushes or whatever, I feel it to be good and true and authentic, then that's where it leads. But I didn't necessarily have, you know, a theme. It's just usually a kind of a pulse of where the country is and where my life is and where my personal growth is. But I think any music is, and anything I've done in this and I've found recently, has just been about, and I used to think it was about other things, but I think it's just about personal growth in general. You know, and whatever gets in your way and everything is doesn't really matter. I think it's all about the growth you can make as a human being, because there's times when I thought, oh man, it'll make me enough money so I can stop selling tickets, or I can, you know, little things like that, or I can meet some pretty women or whatever it is. You know, it's just, I think all the things over the years have just been really to kind of spiritually grow.
Did you grow from this record?
Yeah. Every time you do something, every time I play a show, I still learn something.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the one question that came from Aaron, which is, if I know that songs, it's important for them to mean something to you, whatever that may be, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be whatever the writer wrote or was feeling. But is there some kind of a story to Let the Drummer Kick?
There's a couple stories to it. I've written all the song in my old apartment or my old studio, and played the piano and the drum. I had a drum machine, and just played the parts. And I'm not a great piano player or any of that, but it's very basic. And did the chorus, and I hadn't finished it, and I was trying to finish it for a long time. But I guess the meaning of it, there was a guy next door to me, and his name was Mr. Copeland, which is
ironic.
Yeah. And he was living in the same building, and he used to always say, Clarence, whatever you do, don't give up.
Aww.
And so I said that at the beginning of Let the Drummer Kick It, whatever you do, don't give up. And I think that gives it kind of a vibe of that. I think that song embodies that. And
it was a big hit. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Pretty Intense podcast today. I hope you enjoyed it. And also, thank you so much, Trevor Hall, for the awesome music. If you like what you heard today and you want to hear more, please click on the subscribe button.